So welcome everyone to this second day of our symposium on Agrippa. And next we're going to have quite an extraordinary panel of key players in the celebrated transmission of Agrippa that occurred on the 9th of December 1992. And a number of these individuals have never publicly stated who they are, and will be doing so for the first time today. So each will go in turn and talk about their experience of the transmission event. But in advance of that, we are going to play a video of one of the launches at the Americas Society in New York. And then we'll follow that by showing just a few documents from the archive of Agrippa here at the Bodleian. And then we'll let our panelists tell us some more about the whole event. So I think without further ado, let's begin.
Thank you all for coming here. I'm Laura Blum, Director of Program Development here, and I'm delighted to recognize some of the faces from part one of our cyber mini-series, which featured William Gibson and Jack Womack. Jack's back with us again tonight. Tonight is the second and final episode starring Agrippa, a Book of the Dead, Gibson's withering computer disk story of the withering of his father. In the best Brechtian tradition, we have exposed the seams of our set, a Mac PowerBook 180, interfaced with a Hi8 video, a Sony VPH1041Q, and a BNC connector. I have trouble with can openers, but one of the boons of this whole project is that I now hurl around words like radius power view and LCD panel, as if I owned them. When the Kansas City Agrippa site called last week to share panics, I coolly said that I was contemplating using our Sony projector with a CGD monitor hooked up to a 9-pin connector, and specifically an SYN9M part 2603904, which, for those of you who don't know, is a 9-pin connector to 4 BNC connectors. Now I'll turn the evening over to people who really know what they're talking about. The flow of the evening is that Kevin Bigas, publisher of Agrippa and other limited edition art books, will first discuss the project with Karen Bedfield, associate producer with the Wall Street Journal Television Report. And then, in the spirit of disembodied texts, you'll hear the disembodied voice of Penn Jillette, of Penn and Teller, and performance duo, in a pre-recorded reading of Agrippa as it scrolls on the screen. Kevin will be back for questions afterwards. And finally, we'll drink to postmodernity amidst Agrippa designer Dennis Ashwa's DNA portrait paintings upstairs. Please join me in welcoming Kevin Bigas and Karen Bedfield.
Before untying the bow that bound this book together, a black book, albums. C.A. Agrippa, order extra leaves by letter and name. A Kodak album of time-burned black construction paper. The string he tied has been unraveled by years and the dry weather of trunks. Like a lady's shoestring from the First World War, its metal furls eaten by oxygen until they resemble cigarette ash. Inside the cover, he inscribes something in soft graphite, now lost, and his name, William F. Gibson, Jr., and something, comma, 1924. Then he glued his Kodak prints down and wrote under them in chalk-like white pencil, Papa's Sawmill, August 1919. Yes? No, we can't. We've already started. We can't go back.
Okay, so thank you. If you want to actually read more, can we share again the link to the transmission event to all the online audience? So I think that's it. So thank you very much, Dan and Wade. And so now, following that, I'm just going to show like archival materials that we have here in the archive at the Bodleian that was donated by Kevin Pickles Jr. in 2011. And these archival materials, they relate to two things. So one actually is related to another launch event that actually happened for Agrippa that was also in New York, but at the kitchen this time. So I first show this material. So here, and thank you, Lauren Amading and John Maxwell Hart were among our speakers, and they will be able to tell us actually more about what is this document. So this is a letter of agreement that was actually signed by one of our panelists here today, Lauren Amading, director of the kitchen, and it is an agreement about what exactly will be the launch event of Agrippa at the kitchen. And you didn't have Penn Jillette. You had Robert Ashley as an artist to read the poem. And I believe that John will also tell us more about all of that and how it, you know, worked out and why you went with actually somebody reading the poem live. So there is that first document, which I think everybody now can see. The second document, which I'm going to show, is actually this little draft of what was supposed to be the transmission. And fortunate here to have actually as a panelist, Mark Scarpa was actually at the time the producer in charge of the netcast broadcasting of Agrippa, and that will explain us more what is this document presenting. And he just told us actually this document is in the hand of Dennis Ashbo, and he has another document that compares to that. And so I'll hand it over to you, Mark, to introduce yourself and tell us what is this document and everything about your engagement with Agrippa. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Just a little background. Thank you, everyone. I'm honored to be here, and it's good to see some old friends and new ones. A lot of us collaborated on this project and didn't meet and or know each other at the time, and that was sort of the part of the whole vision of Agrippa the Transmission, the idea that everyone could come together with this very interesting story that was part of Agrippa Book of the Dead. And that it would, in essence, metastasize or become a virus, if you will, where the story would be placed on one bulletin board service in one way, and then it would be shared with another one, and so on and so on. However, it might change and grow and evolve to the point where the story would actually change and grow and evolve. In speaking with Bill at that time, his hope and desire was that it would, grow into thousands or hundreds of thousands of different versions of the story. And ironically, now 30 years later, and we're all getting together, it seems as though his vision was realized. So we should really owe a debt of gratitude to both Bill and Kevin and Dennis for leading the way in this project, which is just a very quirky art project at the time that was able to try a lot of new ideas. And fortunately, there were a lot of other quirky folks like myself and everyone else in this session that thought it was a good idea. And let's all gravitate towards it and try to make it happen. The transmission side of this, I had stumbled upon having met Bill through my work at CBS News, we had done a story about him that was unrelated to Agrippa. And also as a result, I had gotten connected to Dennis Ashbaugh. Dennis then put me in touch with Kevin Bigas, and you know, the book was already well underway, and the idea of the transmission sort of manifested. And you did see a version of the drawing there. But if I can share my screen, this was my original drawing here. And I think that drawing, as I mentioned, was done by Kevin. Not Kevin, sorry, it was done by Dennis after I had done this one. So this was sort of, you know, at that time, I was a phone freaker and had been online since 1980, 1981. So very familiar with bulletin boards and so on. But the idea of actually having an auto dial infrastructure, the thought was that the book itself, or the words from the story, would go to one bulletin board, be published one way, then go to the next one, the next one, the next one. So in essence, instead of what we now understand as webcasting, where it's one source to many from a server and receiver standpoint, we had to actually dial up each bulletin board and post each one of these versions of the story. And we're trying to figure out, well, how do we do that in an automated way? How can it be done potentially? We were even thinking of audio and video back then as a way to actually maybe shoot some video and have it sent, published, and available for download, which was obviously way ahead of its time since that technology really didn't exist at that time. And we also were looking at other ways to get it to individual destinations in a faster capacity. And there was, you know, a networking situation or technology that was called Switch 56, which is, in essence, 56.6, you know, modem technology or bandwidth. At that time, it was like 8-bit, 14.4, 28.8 really wasn't even a reality on a daily level, per se. It was there, but you know, you started to look at these new technologies in terms of bandwidth architecture, which was Switch 56, and that was actually a thing at the time. And we thought, wow, now with Switch 56, we actually can send audio and video. So needless to say, a lot of these drawings here, this original drawing, was just us whiteboarding. Then that turned into looking at sort of a more in-depth, okay, what is this really going to look like in terms of, instead of doing it live on all these different destinations at the same time, because that was the idea, was how let's get a bunch of modems together that would then dial all of these bulletin boards at exactly the same time using Switch 56 and then post it all simultaneously. And in essence, we were thinking about it from a broadcast perspective, and what we ended up doing is more of a delayed transmission that also included a presentation with it. And so you can see the technical flowchart here, where we had the disk, the CPU, the monitor, the outgoing modem, the telephone line, at that time with 9600 baud, the incoming modem, the terminal program to run the script. And then at certain sites around the world, the thought was that they would have all these sort of watch parties, if you will, where it would come in and it would be projected onto the screen, just like ironically we're doing now very easily with Zoom. And then you'd have a CPU monitor there in the location. So as you can see, this was all very academic and in many ways unrealistic at the time, but it was something that, you know, ended up being sort of a roadmap for where we are today with broadcasts in general. What else is here is sort of just, I think this was my outline of a weekly report that I sent to Kevin. We were looking for sponsorships at the time. We were looking at primary and secondary test locations, as well as primary and secondary locations. for these watch parties, if you will. And ultimately, our goal here was to achieve electric mothership connection, as I would like to say. And so we had a lot of fun with it. And, my career, this really sort of sparked my interest in the idea of being able to send and transmit information, in a streaming capacity, which again didn't exist at that time, later on. And that was what my career turned out to be, is doing the first large online webcast in history, which was the Free Tibet Festival, just some 4 years later in 1996, using real video technology, or real audio and real video technology, with a slight detour prior to that using Zing Streamworks about 1995. So it really all started with this project, and just sort of grew from there. So I'm not sure what else I could mention off the top of my head. Here's the drawing that you have, I believe. And this is, again, Dennis and I kind of playing, from what I recall, with the original drawing and looking at how this could all come together. And of course, tying into the event that eventually wound up happening at the kitchen. So we didn't end up doing watch parties all around the world. We ended up doing one event at the kitchen that was hosted by John, and it went swimmingly well. It was a great event. We also had a party as well that everyone attended, which was kind of fun. And we did get these transmissions out to a select group of locations, and a lot of the other colleagues here took the, I guess, format or the model that we put together and went ahead and shared it with different bulletin boards. So I think we started out with very grandiose ideas of being able to hit everyone all at once in one big shot with watch parties all around the world, to we had one event in New York City with all of us sort of taking the story individually and sending it to different bulletin boards, and it slowly caught on. So the traction, it gained momentum over years and years and years, obviously. But we did start out with that very, very large vision. And, it wound up, practicality-wise, being something that was done very organic and ultimately in a very Bill-esque way, very underground and very cypherpunk. So I was very proud to be a part of this project. We all really didn't know what the hell we were doing, but we just went ahead and did it. And so there you go. That's a sort of a beginning of the conversation, I guess. Kick it off to my colleagues.
Well done. Well done then, and well done now. I am Lauren Amzine, and excuse me, I'm getting sentimental here. I was director of the kitchen in those days. Excuse me. Cheers. All right. We were the downtown, and it, as it turned out, the only space. And we were the perfect space for this event to happen. And so I thought what I would do is give some sort of a, just give you the environment of the time. And basically, the kitchen was the kind of place that people who maybe didn't fit somewhere else or anywhere else, they fit with us. And it was just a natural connection. And in those days, works were described, artists weren't that interested in being branded or in being classified necessarily. And so the way that we framed everything was works would be described as works in progress, experimental, interdisciplinary projects. When we brought people in, we weren't looking necessarily for a finished or a polished event or work or work in progress. It was more about the experience and the development of the ideas, the intellect, the creative process. And
there was always, me as the director, I always made sure that there was room for the unexpected, room for the unanticipated, and room for people that might just happen to be in town and had a really good idea, and they were welcome. So, and for a lot of the artists at that point, it was not about the market at all. In fact, they didn't really want to be part of the market, although a lot of the work that started at the kitchen ended up being nowadays mainstream, shall we say, or it's developed into that. And the way I would describe it was raw and rigorous, and it was about creative experience, expression and experience. And what I thought I would do is just read to you the way that we wrote about that project for the little press that we were able to do. What we did, you saw the contract, and what the contract was about was we offered them our space, all our team, and all our expertise, and that's what we contributed to it. There wasn't a lot of, it wasn't necessarily transactional, but we all collaborated, and we had a great space, and we had a great community, and we had a great team, of which John was the head of the team. So I thought I would just read you so you get a little taste of the way that we described it. Agrippa exists in various forms, a computer disk, a battered old book, and a global fireside chat. The story is told in words, pictures, sounds, smells, and the passage of time, and will be broadcast to dozens of sites around the world at the same moment. The live presentation of Agrippa will be, by its nature, a mutation of the original book project, presented in a form radically different from traditional ways of experiencing literature and art. Agrippa, the transmission, should not be confused with the published version of Agrippa. The book is an art object with weight, smell, and texture, while the transmission tells another aspect of the story and hastens a new form of tribal storytelling. And then we went on to describe a little bit about the usage of the disc, etc. And I'll just read you this one sentence. However, the disc is encrypted with a specially designed program which will destroy the text after the first reading. The reader must make an irreversible decision, for the story cannot be stopped, copied, or printed once it is set in motion. There you go.
Hi, I'm John Maxwell Hobbs. I also was at the kitchen at that time. I was the producing director and also responsible for what we were doing in new technologies at that point. The kitchen was the first arts organization in the world to be on the internet. And at that point, that was prior to anything outside of academia being on the web. So we communicated using Finger and Gopher. Look those up, right? You would finger the kitchen to get the schedule. And that was also back in the days when an institution, didn't matter how many staff members you had, had one email address. And we were the kitchen at panix.com. Panix was the first ISP in New York. And it was very interesting. What Mark was saying had jogged my memory. At that point, the internet was just one of a number of different ways to communicate online, and wasn't necessarily the primary one as well. And Mark had mentioned the bulletin board system, and that actually was very robust and had been around for quite a long time, a little system called FidoNet. So basically, you could communicate with someone on a different bulletin board, but you had to log on, upload your material, and then sign off. And then at some point within the next 24 to 48 hours, one bulletin board would communicate with another and hand over a whole package of information. So that was a very slow and very asynchronous way of moving things around. So it made a lot of sense for this project to come to the kitchen, because we've been thinking in very similar ways. And Mark's, the Venn diagram of Mark's career and my career have overlapped multiple times over the years, along with a lot of other people, but it was very interesting to see in that fashion. And I still remember the Agrippa team had come to the kitchen as they were still assembling everything, including the book itself. So there were still things that were up in the air. And I just remember this vision was someone, and nobody was sure at that point who it would be reading it in a barn somewhere in the middle of the United States, transmitting to cities and other locations, delivering things via FidoNet or via audio. And this was even, I think, early tests were being done with CUC, me at Cornell and things like that, but it was long, long, long before multimedia was really being transmitted other than through military and academic institutions. And I'll hand over to the next person, because the rest of the things in my head probably fit better in the discussion of how it was done. So.
Rosanna, I think, is going to be the next person.
Well, hello. My name is Daniel Solinger. I'm a film producer based in Los Angeles. And at the time, I was a student at New York University in the film department. And I had read Neuromancer and was into a lot of the things. I was on bulletin boards. I was into this sort of thing at the time. And I was taking classes at a graduate level department at NYU at 721 Broadway. It was the interactive telecommunications department. They were on the fourth floor, and the film department was on like the eighth, ninth, and 10th floor. And I would go down there and hang out with the students there and get involved in their projects, which include a lot of interesting, we had a public access channel, and we would do things like set up a camera, shooting out the window at the phone booth on the corner, and call the phone booth and talk to whoever picked up the phone and things like that. And I was aware of the kitchen event, and I didn't make it, but I was aware of it. But then somebody, an administrator at the interactive telecommunications program, had mentioned that they were looking for a video crew to help with the event at the American Society. And I volunteered immediately. I called my friend Scott, who was much more into these things than I was. And he was very excited about it. And we grabbed, I think we had three cameras. Scott had one, and I think I brought two from the department. And we went up there that night, and Scott had the great idea to put videotapes in the cameras, and we videotaped the event. I'll let Scott pick up what happened after we left the event, but the bottom line was that I had a copy of the material, and I created an experimental video. I had an old editing system that was broken, and the control track was broken, and so I created a experimental video with the material from the transmission and a bunch of added material. And my idea was that the videotape, as you watched it, would degrade over time, that every time you watch it, because the control track was broken, it would fall apart more and more. And I thought that was sort of in line with the spirit of the project. And I handed out, I don't know, less than 30 of them, just to friends and people, interested parties. And somehow years later, I was on the internet. I just typed in Agrippa, and I saw Matthew's website that he was doing, and it was the very exhaustive research into the project. And he had a copy of my video on there. He had an early draft of it, which I have no. I'm very curious how he got it, because, like I said, there were not many copies floating around. It was on analog videotape. But it was, that was part of my vision, was that it would be a digital file that would not degrade. Like, somehow at the time, video was not on the internet, you know. So ultimately, it was realized that there's now this video copy of my experimental video that won't degrade over time. And yeah, I'll let Scott take it from there, his participation.
I just wanted to jump in real quick to say that the website was actually Alan Liu's Agrippa Files website, which I also contributed content to, but the site was done by Alan and the team at UCSB.
And do you know how that video was, how it got to you guys?
Yes, you sent it to me, Daniel.
No, the original, the experimental video.
No, that I do not know.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Scott Gartner, also known as Templar. This is Roseanne Ganji Gartner, also known as Pseudofred from back in the day. Like Mark, I was involved in hacking from the early days. My first big hack was in 1981. I hacked the White Sands missile base into the classified section over the ARPANET. Went on to become a phone freak, part of the Phoneline Phantoms. So I was always involved in that kind of culture. And, you know, we were also fans of William Gibson, and the news about Agrippa was huge. It almost felt like there was a challenge to where Kevin Bigas was trying to challenge everybody to be the first one to hack it. So it was on everybody's mind at the time. It was big news. And so when I got the phone call from Daniel, it was like Willy Wonka getting the golden ticket. It was like, I can't believe this has fallen into our laps like this. So yeah, we grabbed our cameras, we jumped in a taxi. I remember giving the taxi driver an extra 20 to blow some red lights because we were running late. We got up there, and I even had a whole story in my head about if we got caught recording it, that I would say that the cameras only worked if it was actually recording at the time. Then we went back to the office. I was working at a place called Image Zone at the time. And we had recorded it on a Hi8. We had this brand new Hi8 deck that could play things back and do freeze frames without any rolling or tearing. So it was a great little deck for transcribing. And Roseanne here transcribed the entire thing in a mad session over those next couple of hours, and did an incredible job with it. Now, there are still, you know, you talk about Agrippa and the idea of it decaying. And of course, our memories are decaying. There are still a few little nitpicky things that the perception, I think, is a little bit different from reality. Like, for instance, the first transmission of it from our office was actually to our friend Chris Nvidiata up in Buffalo, who then posted it to Usenet. But it was only half of it had gotten through. So he had posted half of it, and then a couple hours later, he had reposted the entire thing. The following morning, I had called up my friend Patrick Krupa, Lord Digital, and posted it to Mindvox. But of course, now the way Usenet works, it would take sometimes days for things to reach from system to system. So from everybody's perception, it certainly looks like Mindvox got it first. But in reality, we had posted it to Usenet just a couple of hours earlier. The rest was history. We had some discussion about the ethics of it, because we respected everybody as artists, and we really didn't want to, you know, break that respect. But it really felt like there was an open challenge to be the first ones to do it, and that on top of the $1,500 price tag, which we were just not going to be able to do, we couldn't really have a good crack at the encryption itself. So that's my story. Roseanne, do you want to say anything about the?
I mean, I can say that the story is about the ephemerality of memory, and my memory is really rather slim on the night. I remember the darkness at the, sitting in the dark and watching the transmission itself. I remember rushing and hastily typing. And, you know, I think now thinking back on it, And I work now with dementia patients. I'm a speech language pathologist, about how important it is to maintain memory and at the same time, knowing that our memory does degrade in such a natural way over time. It was so authentic and organic to our real experience. So, it stayed with me in that trace for many years. I enjoyed being part of the project. It felt like a heist. I was 21 and, that little bit of an anarchist in me thought, okay, great, we're going to do something. We're going to buck the system in some way. But truthfully, it was a beautiful piece and reflection from middle age. That tribute to his father, the idea of these old photographs, the idea of even not knowing who's in the photo, looking through stacks of family photos and realizing that without the photographer with you, without good recall, without good notes, it's like you have to attribute something to them that you give your own spin to, you give your own perspective. So memory is never truly that perfect, despite how faithful to the text we tried to be to make sure that it was accurate. I think that's, it was fun to contribute.
And in the end, we just followed the ethos or the common phrase at the time, which was that information just wants to be free. And Bob, that's our story. I'll hand it back to you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That was wonderful. Thank you. Could I just ask about the actual the videotape in the machine and the commission to go to the American Society and how that actually worked? Was it Kevin who commissioned you to go there to film the event? What was the surreptitious element? And then the other thing I'm interested in is just if you could say a little bit more about this business of transcription. Were you transcribing from a video? What was the purpose? What was the purpose of that?
I'll take the Kevin Bagos piece, which is that he had contacted the Interactive Telecommunications Department at New York University to have a team. Their concern at the time was that they were going to play it on that the laptop that you see in the video, but the screen is too small for an audience, so they needed to be able to project it onto a projector, which is, I guess, the technical challenge that the woman at the head of the video that we watched was talking about, the technical challenge of transmitting the screen of the poem unraveling onto a large screen for an audience to watch. And this administrator was a gentleman named George Guido, who had been contacted by Kevin Bagos to perform this. It was the one who tapped me and another a student there at the ITP to do this. I did visit Kevin Bagos a few days after, and he had had a fax of the MindVox post, and it was interesting because he was quite amused, I think, that it had been transcribed and put on the internet, because it existed. Agrippa, existed only as this poem that was on this disc that you would put into a computer, and then once you watched it once, it would encrypt itself and you couldn't see it again. So the actual text was very hard for anybody to know or without purchasing. I think the cost of the book was, I thought it was $2,000, maybe it was $1,500, and they only made, I think, 200 of them. So it was a very, it was a very hard to access piece of text. And I think as Scott was saying, I think our ethos at the time, we were young and, had a real desire to sort of democratize the text or to make it available to everyone for free, rather than it be this thing that was, art collectors would buy and it would just sit on their shelf or what have you. So it was more than just a bit of a mission, I think, for me at least. to take it and make it available to the general public. I'll let Scott talk about the transmission, but I would say that I think the assumption when Kevin Bega, or the assumption from the ITP's point of view, was that we were there solely for the purpose of projecting this laptop screen onto a large screen that everybody can see. The other student who was with us felt quite betrayed that we had that Scott had taken it and that they had transcribed it. That was a real break of trust. That we had done that. I'll let Scott talk about the transcription.
Well, from a technical point of view, yes, we recorded it on Hi8, which was a great format for that kind of thing. And at the office, I had a computer system and a Hi8 deck side by side. So we just played back the tape and Roseanne furiously typed away at it. I don't know if there's anything else you want to say about the actual transcription.
No, I think, like I said, it was important to me to be as faithful as possible to the original. And we had thankfully we had the technology to freeze frame. Otherwise, it would have been such a challenge in the replay of the audio again and again. So it was less time than maybe a traditional audio transcription might have been.
Here's a funny little antidote just to add. The irony is that the discs in the books actually had different versions of the story to begin with. And wow. So, the one that was chosen for what was the main showcasing of it at the kitchen was one version of the story. It was always the intent of Bill to have the story again sort of be a virus, if you will, and for there to be different versions of the transmission posted on different bulletin boards. And that started with the origination story in the book itself. So he had a couple of different versions. There were slight variations just in wording. And so, if you go and you look at some of the archive versions, you guys have your version, and then you see some other folks did screenshots of what we eventually did, which was posting it on different bulletin boards. And as it was mentioned earlier, those bulletin boards then shared it with other bulletin boards, and it sort of was changed and it grew and it became, in essence, the first piece of viral text, if you will. He was very much into nostalgia and antiques and books and very much about the idea of the temporary society in many ways. It all started with the physical books, and then that ethos evolved into the transmission. And again, as it pointed out earlier, we weren't able to do the grandiose idea where we were, in essence, broadcasting to all these different venues simultaneously in one shot, with watch parties at each one. So these folks were recording what was going on at the kitchen, and then thankfully preserved it and then shared it from there. But we were also sending it out onto bulletin boards, up until and leading into that night, and then of course from that night on. So I'm not sure how many versions of the story there are. I don't think Bill knows either. I think his intent was that other people would even change the words themselves and have it grow as an organism in some way, and that it would take on a life of its own, which again, clearly it has, because we're all here gathered together 30 years later at one of the most prestigious universities in the world discussing this project. So there you go. He was right.
I wonder if there are any questions either on the chat or in the room that people might like to ask of our panelists. Let's start with Justine, who obviously is doing her PhD on this, and I think the symposium must have been pretty good for you. Justine.
Thank you, Chris. Actually, my question, my credit to exactly what Scott Dan wrote a Mark Wessing, and actually it's kind of for you, John and Lauren, compared to that, because right now we saw the launch event at the American Society, Mark spoke about the bulletin board, but I remember when we had the discussion together, you said that it was different at the kitchen, you know, like basically you commissioned somebody, an artist, to read the poem there, because you were not able actually to transmit the poem to other locations. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that, the choice of the artist, and also, like Lauren, you mentioned Society of the Americas, the kitchen, the different vibe, uptown, downtown, the choice of people.
Yeah, and well, so what happened, and I was
referring to the press release that Lauren read, which is dated the 16th of October of that year. And so at that point, we were still presenting it that there would be a transmission and that we would be connected to different different sites. And if you look at the contract that you showed, that's actually dated the day of the presentation at the kitchen on December 9th. So it was up until the last minute, we were, you know, as Mark knows, we were hoping that New York, well, Bell Telephone would come through with the lines that we needed, which never happened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
The famous switch 56 lines. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. So we were in a building that had four regular telephone lines, and that wasn't going to be able to happen. So as a producer, you know, the show must go on, and we'd sold tickets and had a certain amount of press and all of that. So it came to me that we actually had the perfect person to be involved in this, and this is the composer, Robert Ashley. Bob Ashley was not only on the board of directors of the kitchen, but he was a contemporary of John Cage and had created an entire type. It was what he called opera for television, which back then kind of meant a lot more than now, because everybody can have their own television channel today. But back then it was a very special thing, and his specific style was focused on the spoken word as music. So reading the text that William Gibson talked about or had written, and thinking about Bob's style, which was very deliberate and kind of slow, and having watched the speed of the app presenting the text, it was absolutely perfect. So we set up in our second floor space, which was a more flexible studio space. And it was a very interesting experience hearing the story from the American Society, jogged my memory as well. These days it's like HDMI cable into a projector. You know, back then, no, you could not connect your computer to a projector, and the projector was a three-gun Sony that took about an hour to set up, because you actually had to register it the way you register three-color printing and things like that, a grid that had to match. And then you had to point a camera at the screen. And so that's what we did. We had a camera pointed at the screen with a large projection, and Bob at a table and a chair, basically reading it as it scrolled by on the screen.
Yep.
Centered in a room that was completely black around him, with the audience sitting around him. And it was a very, very sort of special event that way. And we did record it as well. The recording should probably be part of the kitchen archive that's now held by the Getty.
Okay.
So it would be
what we're doing. Yeah, I would.
On the subject, on the subject of recordings and tapes, I think Matt wanted to come in.
Yes, thank you. I do have something to share, and I hope I can get a good camera view. I had it for, let's see.
We saw viewer's hammer written on it.
Yeah, so what if I'm you holding take the, here, and...
If you unblur your Zoom screen, it will, it will work.
Let me take a quick moment to do that. So what I am holding is a 3/4 inch NTSC videotape. This is a copy, as I understand it, of the original Hi8 tape. And this is the source, there we are. This is the source for the footage that is publicly available on YouTube. The casing, you'll notice, says Re Agrippa, which is the title, Daniel, you gave to your remix. There's Rose Hammer with what appears ironically enough to be a copyright symbol. On the spine is your, what I take to be your sigil, a crossed rose and hammer. And the tape itself, the label reads, Agrippa Scott's view. And so this is the tape you had sent me, Daniel, in 2007 or 2008. We digitized the video here at the University of Maryland. And again, that became the source of the recording that's currently on YouTube. What I would like to do with this, with everybody's blessing, is contribute it to the collection at the Bodleian. And I can correspond with Chris about the procedure for that afterwards.
I'll be in touch immediately, Matt. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The copyright was ironically placed. It was not.
I assume so.
Yeah, we that is funny. Sort of everyone took a bit of ownership of the project in a way, and it was supposed to be a project where no one had ownership of it. The open source story, if you will, and during the exhibition at the kitchen, we were still actually posting it to other bulletin boards at the time, it's important to remember that the I didn't have the opportunity to go to the American Society of that, but the kitchen experience, what really made that exhibition of this premier exhibition, I should say, of all things Agrippa. It was the book, it was the transmission, it was the curiosity of the idea of virality, of a story. It was just an amazing group of people that got together to really just try to understand and make sense of where the future was going. And what we could do to empower artists and storytellers alike to have a new form of self-expression and to play with that medium. And I think that was probably the most exciting thing for me there, is just the excitement of uncertainty and having the opportunity to have that forum at the kitchen, where a lot of artists had come through throughout the years, just to try again, just wacky things as well as very academic things, as well as just incredible art. So it was a special moment. John, I don't know if you recall, you came to the party that we did as well prior to that, and I was just digging this up. I'll share it real quick. Should you remember this? So we did a party prior to the exhibition at the kitchen at a place on the Lower East Side called Stella's. I think it turned into like a Chinese restaurant later on. But you can see here, the invite was burnt. So the theme of this sort of old ancient work will carry through even into the party invites and into the virality of the netcast itself. So just a little side note, hope I didn't take too much time sharing that. I thought it was a nice antidote.
Actually, you did event, and that's great because yesterday we saw a copy that belonged to the collector Alan Chazanoff, and he had an invitation inside, and we had been wondering since, was it an invitation to the launch event, or was it an invitation to this private party beforehand? So thanks to you, now we have the answer. Thank you. So I'm conscious of time. And at the same time, I would like to continue this discussion for a long time, but what I'm offering to do is that I had a question for Lauren. So if she could answer that question, that would be amazing. And then for everyone, I know I can see there are like plenty of people who are writing in the chat and the Q&A. So we have a huge Q&A session that will be led by Jason Scott Warren from 4:15 to 5 UK time. So everyone can come back and ask all of their questions. And I hope if you still have time for, Mark, Roseanne, Scott, and Daniel, and Matt, who have been joining us from across the Atlantic, to come back at the, the Q&A session, that would be great because I'm sure there will be more questions for you. So yes, my next question was for you, Lauren. And it was about difference between like the kitchen and the American societies and what you mentioned, but like uptown, downtown.
Well, in those days, there was a big distinction between uptown and downtown, especially in the
arts. That is true.
And now downtown has basically moved to Brooklyn. And now Brooklyn would be similar to that. Real estate is much different now. So there is, the downtown was a lot about real estate as well. Artists and creative people could afford to live in the downtown. And as a result, a whole culture evolved and became very strong. And so we were part of the downtown. And also our building, the building that the kitchen had moved into, was an old ice house. So it was also perfect for this sort of an event because it was like a fortress and there were very few windows inside and all the walls were painted black. We had two black box event spaces. So that was, it for whatever reason, it all came together aesthetically as well as.
Robert Ashley,
yes,
and Gillette, who at the time was.
Yes, Penn Jillette would have been a perfect choice for Uptown.
Okay.
And actually for Uptown, he was considered wild. Whereas for Downtown, it would be Robert Ashley. He would be the epitome of what we would want. Yes.
Great.
Wonderful. Well, we'll take a quick break for tea, I think, till 3:15. And, meanwhile, please join me in thanking our panelists here and aboard. So thank you.